Audio Renaissance presents Hunters of Dune by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, based on an outline by Frank Herbert. Read for you by Scott Brick. Author's note: we wish Frank Herbert could have been here to write this book. After the publication of Heretics of Dune, 1984, and Chapter House Dune, 1985, he had much more in mind for the story, a fantastic grand climax to the epic Dune Chronicles. Anyone who has read Chapter House knows the excruciating cliffhanger ending. The last novel Frank Herbert wrote, Man of Two Worlds, was a collaboration with Brian, and the two of them discussed working on future Dune books together, particularly the story of the Butlerian Jihad. However, with the beautiful dedication and coda that Frank wrote at the end of Chapter House, a loving tribute to his wife Beverly, Brian originally thought that the Dune Chronicles should end there. As he explained in Dreamer of Dune, the biography of Frank Herbert, his parents had been a writing team, and they were gone. So Brian left the series untouched for many years. In 1997, more than a decade after the death of his father, Brian began to discuss with Kevin J. Anderson the possibility of completing the project, of writing the fabled Dune 7. But apparently Frank Herbert had left no notes, and we thought we would have to do the project based solely on our own imaginations. After further discussions, we realized that a great deal of preliminary work needed to be completed before we could tackle Dune 7, not just laying groundwork for the story itself, but also reintroducing the book-buying audience and a whole new generation of readers to the incredible, highly imaginative Dune universe. More than 20 years have passed since the publication of Chapter House Dune. While many readers loved the original classic Dune or even the first three books in the series, a significant portion of the audience had not continued all the way through to that last book. We needed to reawaken interest and get those readers prepared. We decided to write a trilogy of prequels first: the prelude series of House Atreides, House Harkonnen, and House Carino. When we began to dig through all of Frank Herbert's stored papers in preparation for writing House Atreides, Brian was surprised to learn of two safe deposit boxes that his father had taken out before his death. Inside the boxes, Brian and an estate attorney discovered a dot matrix printout and two old-style computer disks labeled Dune 7 Outline and Dune 7 Notes, pages describing exactly where the creator of Dune had intended to take his story. Reading this material, we saw instantly that Dune 7 would be a magnificent culmination of the series, tying together the history and the characters we all knew in an exciting plot with many twists, turns, and surprises. In storage, we also discovered additional notes and papers describing characters and their histories, pages of unused epigraphs, and outlines for other works. Now that we had a roadmap in front of us, we plunged into the Prelude to Dune trilogy, which followed the stories of Duke Leto and Lady Jessica, the evil Baron Harkonnen, and the planetologist Pardo Kynes. After that trilogy, we wrote the Legends of Dune: the Butlerian Jihad, the Machine Crusade, and the Battle of Corin, which introduced the seminal conflicts and events that form the foundations of the whole Dune universe. Indisputably, Frank Herbert was a genius. Dune is the best-selling and most beloved science fiction novel of all time. From the beginning of our monumental task, we realized that it would not only be impossible, but also foolish, to attempt to imitate Frank Herbert's writing style. Both of us were strongly influenced by his writing, and some fans have remarked on certain similarities in style. However, we consciously chose to write these books to capture the feel and scope of Dune, using aspects of Frank Herbert's style, but with our own pacing and syntax. We are pleased to report that since the publication of House Atreides, the sales of Frank Herbert's original Dune Chronicles have gone up dramatically. two six-hour TV miniseries starring William Hurt and Susan Sarandon. Frank Herbert's Dune and Frank Herbert's Children of Dune have been broadcast to large audiences and wide acclaim, while winning Emmy Awards. They are two of the three most watched shows in the history of the Sci-Fi Channel. At last, after more than 9 years of preparation, we feel the time is right for Dune 7. Upon poring over Frank Herbert's outline and notes, we realized that the breadth and scope of the story would have resulted in a novel of more than 1,300 pages. For this reason, the story is being presented in two volumes, Hunters of Dune and the forthcoming Sandworms of Dune. Much more of the epic remains to be written, and we intend to create additional exciting novels telling other parts of the grand, brilliant tale that Frank Herbert laid out. The saga of Dune is far from over. Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, April 2006. Following the 3,500-year reign of the tyrant Leto II, an empire was left to fend for itself. During the famine times and the subsequent scattering, the remnants of the human race cast themselves far into the wilderness of space. They fled to unknown realms where they sought riches and safety to no avail. For 1,500 years, these survivors and their descendants endured terrible hardships, a whole reorganization of humanity. Stripped of its energy and resources, the ancient government of the old empire fell away. New power groups took root and grew strong, but never again would humans allow themselves to depend upon a monolithic leader or a key finite substance. Single points of failure. Some say the scattering was Leto II's golden path, a crucible in which to strengthen the human race forever, to teach us a lesson we could not forget. But how could one man, even a man-god who was partially a sandworm, willingly inflict such suffering upon his children? Now that descendants of the lost ones are returning from the scattering, we can only imagine the true horrors our brothers and sisters faced out there. Guild Bank Records, Gamu Branch. Even the most learned of us cannot imagine the scope of the scattering. As a historian, I am dismayed to think of all the knowledge that has been lost forever, the accurate records of triumphs and tragedies. Entire civilizations rose and fell, while those who remained in the old empire sat in complacency. New weapons and technologies were spawned by the hardships of the famine times. What enemies did we inadvertently create? What religions, distortions, and social processes did the tyrant set in motion? We can never know, and I fear that this ignorance will come back to haunt us. Sister Tamerlane, Chapter House Archives. Our own estranged brothers, those lost Tleilaxu who vanished in the turmoil of the scattering, have come back to us. But they are changed in fundamental ways. They bring an improved strain of face dancers with them, asserting that they designed these shapeshifters themselves. My analysis of the lost Tleilaxu, however, indicates that they are clearly inferior to us. They cannot even create spice from axolotl tanks, but they claim to have developed superior face dancers? How can that be? And the honored Matres. They make overtures of alliance, yet their actions show only brutality and the enslavement of conquered peoples. They have destroyed Rakkas. How can we have faith in them or in the lost Tleilaxu? Master Sytale, sealed notes found in burned lab on Tleilax. Duncan Idaho and Shiana have stolen our no-ship and flown off to points unknown. they took with them many heretical sisters, even the Gola of our Bashar Miles Teg. With our newly forged alliance, I am tempted to command all Bene Gesserits and honored Matres to turn their attention to recapturing this ship and its valuable passengers. But I will not. Who can find a no-ship out in the vast universe? More importantly, we can never forget that a far more dangerous enemy is coming for us. Emergency message from Mirbella, Reverend Mother Superior and Great Honored Matre. 3 years after escape from Chapter House. Memory is a weapon sharp enough to inflict deep wounds. The Mentats lament. On the day he died, Rakkis, the planet commonly known as Dune, died with him. Dune, lost forever. In the archives chamber of the fleeing no-ship Ithaca, the Gola of Miles Teg reviewed the desert world's final moments. Melange-scented steam wafted from a stimulant beverage at his left elbow, but the 13-year-old ignored it, descending instead into deep Mentat focus. These historical records and holo-images held great fascination for him. This was where and how his original body had been killed, how an entire world had been murdered. Rakkis, the legendary desert planet, now no more than a charred ball. Projected above a flat table, the archival images showed honored Matre war vessels gathering above the mottled tan globe. The immense, undetectable no-ships, like the stolen one on which Teg and his fellow refugees now lived, wielded firepower superior to anything the Bene Gesserit had ever employed. Traditional atomics were little more than a pinprick by comparison. Those new weapons must have been developed out in the scattering. Teg pursued a Mentat projection. Human ingenuity born out of desperation? Or was it something else entirely? In the floating image, the bristling ships opened fire, unleashing incineration waves with devices the Bene Gesserit had since named obliterators. The bombardment had continued until the planet was devoid of life. The sandy dunes were turned to black glass. Even Rakkis's atmosphere caught fire. Giant worms and sprawling cities, people and sand plankton, everything annihilated. Nothing could have survived down there. Not even him. Now, nearly 14 years later, and in a vastly changed universe, the gangly teenager adjusted the study chair to a more comfortable height. Reviewing the circumstances of my own death. Again. By strict definition, Teg himself was a clone rather than a Gola grown of cells gathered from a dead body, though the latter was the word most people used to describe him. Inside his young flesh lived an old man, a veteran of numerous campaigns for the Bene Gesserit. He could not remember the last few moments of his life, but these records left little doubt. The senseless annihilation of Dune demonstrated the true ruthlessness of the honored Matres. Whores, the Sisterhood called them, and with good reason. Nudging the intuitive finger controls, he called up the images yet again. It felt odd to be an outside observer, knowing that he himself had been down there fighting and dying when these images were recorded. Teg heard a sound at the door of the archives and saw Shiana watching him from the corridor. Her face was lean and angular, her skin brown from Arrakian heritage. The unruly umber hair flashed with streaks of copper from a childhood spent under the desert sun. Her eyes were the total blue of lifelong melange consumption, as well as the spice agony that had turned her into a reverend mother. The youngest ever to survive, Teg had been told. Shiana's generous lips held an elusive smile. Studying battles again, Miles? It's a bad thing for a military commander to be so predictable. I have a great many of them to review, Teg answered in his cracking young man's voice. The Bashar accomplished a great deal in 300 standard years. Before I died. When Shiana recognized the projected record, her expression fell into a troubled mask. Teg had been watching those images of Rakkis to the point of obsession ever since they fled into this bizarre and uncharted universe. Any word from Duncan yet? He asked, trying to divert her attention. He was attempting a new navigation algorithm to get us away from... We know exactly where we are. Shiana lifted her chin in an unconscious gesture she had come to use more and more often since becoming the leader of this group of refugees. We are lost. Teg automatically intercepted the criticism of Duncan Idaho. It had been their intent to prevent anyone, the honored Matres, the corrupted Bene Gesserit order, or the mysterious enemy, from finding the ship. At least we're safe. Shiana did not seem convinced. So many unknowns trouble me. Our location. Who is chasing us? Her voice trailed off, and then she said, I will leave you to your studies. We are about to have another meeting to discuss our situation. He perked up. Has anything changed? No, Miles. And I expect the same arguments over and over again. She shrugged. The other sisters seem to insist on it. With a quiet rustle of robes, she exited the archives chamber, leaving him with the humming silence of the great invisible ship. Back to Rakkis. Back to my death and the events leading up to it. Teg rewound the recordings, gathering old reports and perspectives, and watched them yet again, traveling farther backward in time. Now that his golem memories had been awakened, he knew what he had done up to his death. He did not need these records to see how the old Bashar Teg had gotten into such a predicament on Rakkis, how he himself had provoked it. Back then, he and his loyal men, veterans of his many famous military campaigns, had stolen a no-ship on Gamu, a planet that history had once called Giri Prime, homeworld of the evil but long-exterminated House Harkonnen. Years earlier, Teg had been brought in to guard the young Gola of Duncan, Idaho, after 11 previous Duncan Golas had been assassinated. The old Bashar succeeded in keeping the 12th alive until adulthood and finally restored Duncan's memories, then helped him escape from Gamu. When one of the honored Matres, Mirbella, tried to sexually enslave Duncan, he instead trapped her with unsuspected abilities wired into him by his Tliloxu creators. It turned out that Duncan was a living weapon specifically designed to thwart the honored Matres. No wonder the enraged whores were so desperate to find and kill him. After slaughtering hundreds of honored Matres and their minions, the old Bashar hid among men who had sworn their lives to protect him. No great general had commanded such loyalty since Paul Muad'Dib, perhaps even since the fanatical days of the Butlerian Jihad. Amidst drinks, food, and misty-eyed nostalgia, the Bashar had explained that he needed them to steal a no-ship for him. Though the task seemed impossible, the veterans never questioned a thing. Ensconced in the archives now, young Miles reviewed surveillance records from Gamu's spaceport security, images taken from tall Guild Bank buildings in the city. Each step of the assault made perfect sense to him, even as he studied the records many years later. It was the only way to succeed, and we accomplished it. After flying to Rakkis, Teg and his men had found Reverend Mother Odraid and Shiana riding a giant old worm to meet the no-ship out in the great desert. Time was short. The vengeful, honored Matres would be coming, apoplectic because the Bashar had made fools of them on Gamu. On Rakis, he and his surviving men departed the no-ship with armored vehicles and extra weapons. Time for one last but vital engagement. Before the Bashar led his loyal soldiers out to face the whores, Odraid casually but expertly scratched the skin of his leathery neck, not so subtly collecting cell samples. Both Teg and the Reverend Mother understood it was the Sisterhood's last chance to preserve one of the greatest military minds since the scattering. They realized he was about to die. Miles Tegg's final battle. By the time the Bashar and his men clashed with honored Matres on the ground, other groups of the whores were swiftly taking over the Rakian population centers. They slew the Bene Gesserit sisters who remained behind in Keen. They killed the Tliloxu masters and the priests of the divided god. The battle was already lost, but Teg and his troops hurled themselves against the enemy defenses with unparalleled violence. Since honored Matre hubris would not allow them to accept such humiliation, the horrors retaliated against the whole world, destroying everything and everyone there, including him. In the meantime, the old Bashar's fighters had created a diversion so the no-ship could escape, carrying Odraid, the Duncan Gola, and Shiana, who had tempted the ancient sandworm into the vessel's cavernous cargo hold. Soon after the ship flew to safety, Rakis was destroyed, and that worm became the last of its kind. That had been Teg's first life. His real memories ended there. Watching images of the final bombardment now, Miles Teg wondered at what point his original body had been obliterated. Did it really matter? Now that he was alive again, he had a second chance. Using the cells Odraid had taken from his neck, the Sisterhood grew a copy of their Bashar and triggered his genetic memories. The Bene Gesserit knew they would require his tactical genius in the war with the honored Matres. And the boy Teg had indeed led the Sisterhood to its victory on Gamu and Junction. He had done everything they asked of him. Later, he and Duncan, along with Shiana and her dissidents, had stolen the no-ship yet again and fled from Chapter House, unable to bear what Mirbella was allowing to happen to the Bene Gesserit. Better than anyone else, the escapees understood about the mysterious enemy that continued to hunt for them, no matter how lost the no-ship might be. Weary with facts and forced memories, Teg switched off the records, stretched his thin arms, and left the archive sector. He would spend several hours in vigorous physical training, then work on his weapons skills. Though he lived in the body of a 13-year-old, it was his job to remain ready for everything and never lower his guard. Why ask a man who is already lost to lead you? Why then are you surprised if he leads you nowhere? Duncan, Idaho, 1,000 lives. They were adrift. They were safe. They were lost. An unidentifiable ship in an unidentifiable universe. Alone on the navigation bridge, as he often was, Duncan Idaho knew that powerful enemies were still after them. Threats within threats within threats. The no-ship wandered the frigid void, far from any recorded human exploration. A different universe entirely. He couldn't decide whether they were hiding or trapped. He wouldn't have known how to get back to a familiar star system, even if he'd wanted to. According to the bridge's independent chronometers, they had been in this strange, distorted otherware for years. Though who could say how time flowed in another universe? The laws of physics and the landscape of the galaxy might be completely altered here. Abruptly, as if his concerns had been laced with prescience, he noticed the main instrument panel blinking erratically while the stabilizing engines surged up and down. Though he couldn't see anything more unusual than the now familiar twistings of gases and distorted energy ripples, the no-ship had encountered what he'd come to think of as a rough patch. How could they encounter turbulence in space when nothing was there? The ship shook in a whiplash of strange gravity, jarred by a spray of high-energy particles. When Duncan switched off the automatic piloting systems and altered course, the situation worsened. Barely perceptible flashes of orange light appeared in front of the vessel, like a faint, flickering fire. He felt the deck shudder, as if he had rammed into some obstacle, but he could see nothing. Nothing at all. It should have been an empty vacuum, giving them no sensation of movement or turbulence. Strange universe. Duncan corrected course until the instruments and engines smoothed out and the flashes disappeared. If the danger grew any worse, he might be forced to attempt yet another risky fold space jump. Upon leaving Chapter House, he had flown the no-ship without guidance, having purged all navigation systems and coordinate files, using nothing but his intuition and rudimentary prescience. Each time he activated the Holtzman engines, Duncan gambled with the whole ship and the lives of the 150 refugees aboard. He wouldn't do it unless he had to. 3 years ago, he'd had no choice. Duncan had lifted the great craft from its landing field, not escaping per se, but stealing the entire prison where the Sisterhood had put him. And simply flying away wasn't sufficient. In his attuned mind, he had seen the trap closing around them. The outside enemy observers, in their bizarrely innocuous guises of an old man and an old woman, had a net they could cast across vast distances to entangle the no-ship. He'd seen the sparkling, multicolored mesh begin to contract and the strange old couple smiling with victory. They had thought he and the no-ship were in their grasp. His fingers a blur, his concentration sharp as a diamond chip, Duncan had made the Holtzman engines do things that not even a guild navigator would ask of them. As the enemy's invisible web ensnared the no-ship, Duncan had flung them away, flying the enormous vessel so deeply into the folds of space that he tore the fabric of the universe itself and slid beyond. His ancient swordmaster training had come to his aid. Like a slow blade slipping through an otherwise impenetrable body shield. And the no-ship had found itself somewhere else entirely. But he had remained vigilant, not allowing himself to breathe a sigh of relief. In this incomprehensible universe, what might be next? Now he studied external images transmitted from sensors extended beyond the no-field. The view outside had not changed. Twisted veils of nebula gas. Inside-out streamers that would never condense into stars. Was this a young universe, not yet finished coalescing, or a universe so unspeakably ancient that all suns had burned out and been reduced to molecular ash? The group of misfit refugees desperately wanted to get back to normal, or at the very least, to somewhere else. Over such a long time, their fear and anxiety had faded first to confusion, then to restlessness and malaise. They wanted more than simply being lost and unharmed. Either they looked to Duncan Idaho with hope, or they blamed him for their plight. The ship contained a hodgepodge of humanity's factions. Or did Shiana and her Bene Gesserit sisters view them all as mere specimens? The assortment included a sprinkling of Orthodox Bene Gesserits, acolytes, proctors, reverend mothers, even male workers, along with Duncan himself and the young Miles Teggola. Also aboard were a rabbi and his group of Jews who had been rescued from an attempted Honored Matre pogrom on Gamu, one surviving Tliloxu master, and four animalistic futars, monstrous human-feline hybrids created out in the scattering and enslaved by the whores. In addition, the Great Hold was home to seven small sandworms. Truly, we are a strange mixture. A ship of fools. A year after escaping from Chapter House and becoming mired in this distorted and incomprehensible universe, Shiana and her Bene Gesserit followers had joined Duncan in a christening ceremony. In light of the no-ship's endless wanderings, the name Ithaca seemed appropriate. Ithaca, a small island in ancient Greece, had been the home of Odysseus, who had spent 10 years wandering after the end of the Trojan War, trying to find his way back home. Similarly, Duncan and his companions needed a place to call home, a safe haven. These people were on their own great odyssey, and without so much as a map or a star chart, Duncan was as lost as age-old Odysseus. No one realized how much Duncan longed to go back to Chapter House. Heartstrings linked him to Mirbella, his love, his slave, and master. Breaking free of her had been the single most difficult and painful endeavor he could remember in his multiple lifetimes. He doubted he would ever entirely recover from her. Mirbella. Yet Duncan Idaho had always placed duty above personal feelings. Regardless of the heartache, he assumed responsibility for keeping the no-ship and its passengers safe, even in a skewed universe. At odd times, stray combinations of odors reminded him of Mirbella's distinctive scent. Organic esters that drifted through the no-ship's processed air would strike his olfactory receptors, triggering memories from their 11 years together. Mirbella's perspiration, her dark amber hair, the particular taste of her lips, and the seawater scent of their sexual collisions. Their passionate, codependent encounters had been both intimate and violent for years, with neither of them strong enough to break free. I must not confuse mutual addiction with love. The pain was at least as sharp and unendurable as the debilitating agony of drug withdrawal. Hour by hour, as the no-ship flew through the void, Duncan drew farther from her. He leaned back and opened his unique senses, reaching out, always wary that someone might find the no-ship. The danger in letting himself do this passive sentry duty was that he occasionally descended into muddled wool-gathering about Mirbella. To get around the problem, Duncan compartmentalized his mentat mind. If a portion of it drifted, another portion was always alert, always on the lookout for danger. In their years together, he and Mirbella had produced 4 daughters. The oldest two, twins, would be nearly grown now. But from the moment the agony had transformed his Mirbella into a true Bene Gesserit, she had been lost to him. Because an honored Matre had never before completed training, actually retraining to become a Bene Gesserit reverend mother, the sisterhood had been exceptionally pleased with her. Duncan's shattered heart had been, and still was, merely collateral damage. In his mind's eye, Mirbella's lovely countenance haunted him. His mentat abilities, both a skill and a curse, allowed him to call up every detail of her features. Her oval face and wide brow, the hard green eyes that reminded him of jade, the willowy body that could fight and make love with equal prowess. Then he remembered that her green eyes had become blue after the spice agony. Not the same person. His thoughts wandered, and Mirbella's features shifted in his mind. Like an afterimage burned onto his retinas, another woman began to take shape. He was startled. This was an outside presence, a mind immeasurably superior to his own, searching for him, wrapping gentle strands around the Ithaca. "Duncan, Idaho," a voice called, soothing and feminine. He felt a rush of emotions as well as an awareness of danger. Why hadn't his mentat sentry system seen this coming? His compartmentalized mind snapped into full survival mode. He jumped toward the Holtzman controls, intending once again to fling the no-ship far away, without guidance. The voice tried to intercede. "Duncan, Idaho, do not flee. I am not your enemy." The old man and woman had made similar assurances. Though he had no idea who they were, Duncan did comprehend that they were the real danger. But this new Muley Ibrio presence, this vast intellect, had touched him from outside of the strange, unidentified universe that the no-ship currently inhabited. He struggled to get away, but could not escape the voice. "I am the Oracle of Time." In several of his lives, Duncan had heard of the Oracle, the guiding force of the Spacing Guild. Benevolent and all-seeing, the Oracle of Time was said to be a shepherding presence that had watched over the Guild since its formation 15,000 years ago. Duncan had always considered it an odd manifestation of religion among the hyper-acute navigators. The Oracle is a myth. His fingers hovered over the touchpads of the command console. "I am many things." He was surprised when the voice did not contradict his accusation. "Many seek you. You will be found here." "I trust in my own abilities." Duncan powered up the fold space engines. From her external point of view, he hoped the Oracle wouldn't notice what he was doing. He would take the no-ship somewhere else, fleeing again. How many different powers were hunting them? "The future demands your presence. You have a role to play in Kralizak." Kralizak? Typhoon struggle. The long foretold battle at the end of the universe that would forever change the shape of the future. "Another myth," Duncan said, even as he activated the fold space jump without warning the other passengers. He couldn't risk staying here. How many different forces were hunting them? The no-ship lurched, then plunged once more into the unknown. He heard the voice fading as the ship escaped the Oracle's clutches, but she did not seem dismayed. "Here," the distant voice said, "I will guide you." The intruding voice faded, ripping away like shreds of cotton. The Ithaca careened through fold space and, after an interminably brief instant, tumbled out again. Stars shone all around the ship. Real stars. Duncan studied the sensors, checked the navigation grid, and saw the sparkles of suns and nebulae. Normal space again. Without further verification, he knew that they had fallen back into their own universe. He couldn't decide whether to rejoice or cry out in despair. Duncan no longer sensed the Oracle of Time, nor could he detect any of the likely searchers. The mysterious enemy and the unified sisterhood, though they must still be out there. They would not have given up, not even after 3 years. The no-ship continued to run. The strongest and most altruistic leader, even if his office is dependent on the support of the masses, must look first to the dictates of his heart, never allowing his decisions to be swayed by popular opinion. It is only through courage and strength of character that a true and memorable legacy is ever attained. From Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. Like a dragon empress surveying her subjects, Mirbella sat on a high throne in the large receiving hall of the Bene Gesserit keep. Early morning sunlight poured through the tall stained glass windows, splashing colors around the chamber. Chapter House was the center of a most peculiar civil war. Reverend mothers and honored matres came together with all the finesse of colliding spacecraft. Mirbella, following Odraid's grand plan, allowed them no other option. Chapter House was home to both groups now. Each faction hated Mirbella for the changes she had imposed, and neither had the strength to defy her. Through their union, the conflicting philosophies and societies of the honored matres and the Bene Gesserits merged like horrific Siamese twins. The very concept was appalling to many of them. The potential for reigniting bloodshed was always there, hanging in the air, and the forced alliance teetered on the edge of failure. That was a gamble some in the sisterhood had not been willing to accept. "Survival at the cost of destroying ourselves is no survival at all," Shiana had said just before she and Duncan took the no-ship and flew away. Voting with their feet, as the old saying went. Oh, Duncan. Was it possible that Mother Superior Odraid had not guessed what Shiana planned to do? "Of course I knew," said the voice of Odraid from other memory. "Shiana hid it from me for a long time, but in the end, I knew." "And you chose not to warn me of it?" Mirbella often sparred aloud with the voice of her predecessor, one of the many ancestral inner voices she could access since becoming a reverend mother. "I chose to warn no one. Shiana made her decisions for her own reasons. And now we must both live with the consequences." From her throne, Mirbella watched the guards lead in a female prisoner. Another disciplinary matter for her to handle. Another example she must make. Though such demonstrations appalled the Bene Gesserits, the honored matres appreciated their value. This situation was more important than others, so Mirbella would handle it personally. She smoothed her shimmering black and gold robe across her lap. Unlike the Bene Gesserits, who understood their places and required no ostentatious symbols of rank, honored matres demanded gaudy signs of status, like extravagant thrones or chair dogs, ornate capes in vivid colors. Thus, the self-proclaimed Mother Commander was forced to sit on an imposing throne encrusted with sou stones and fire gems. "Enough to purchase a major planet," she thought, "if there were any I wanted to buy." Mirbella had come to hate the trappings of office, but she knew the necessity. Women in the different costumes of the two orders attended her constantly, alert for any sign of weakness in her. Though they underwent training in the ways of the sisterhood, honored matres clung to their traditional garments, serpent-scribed capes and scarves, and form-fitting leotard bodysuits. By contrast, the Bene Gesserits shunned bright colors and covered themselves with dark, loose robes. The disparity was as clear as that between gaudy peacocks and camouflaged bush wrens. The prisoner, an honored matre named Anine, had short blonde hair and wore a canary yellow leotard with a flamboyant cape of sapphire plaz silk moiré. Electronic restraints kept her arms folded across her midsection as if she wore an invisible straitjacket. A nerve-deadening gag muzzled her mouth. Anine struggled ineffectively against the restraints, and her attempts to speak came out as unintelligible grunts. Guards positioned the rebellious woman at the foot of the steps below the throne. Mirbella focused on the wild eyes that screamed defiance at her. "I no longer wish to hear what you have to say, Anine. You have already said too much." This woman had criticized the Mother Commander's leadership once too often, holding her own meetings and railing against the merging of honored matres and Bene Gesserits. Some of Anine's followers had even disappeared from the main city and established their own base in the uninhabited northern territories. Mirbella could not allow such a provocation to pass unchallenged. The way Anine had handled the matter, embarrassing Mirbella and diminishing her authority and prestige from behind a cloak of cowardly anonymity, had been unforgivable. The Mother Commander knew Anine's type well enough. No negotiation, no compromise, no appeal for understanding would ever change her mind. The woman defined herself through her opposition. A waste of human raw material. Mirbella flashed an expression of disgust. If Anine had only turned her anger against a real enemy. Women of both factions observed from either side of the great hall. The two groups were reluctant to mix, instead separating into whores on one side and witches on the other. Like oil and water. In the years since forcing this unification, Mirbella had come through numerous situations in which she might have been killed, but she eluded every trap, sliding, adapting, administering harsh punishments. Her authority over these women was wholly legitimate. She was both Reverend Mother Superior, selected by Audrade, as well as Great Honored Matre by virtue of assassinating her predecessor. She had chosen the title of Mother Commander for herself to symbolize the integration of the two important ranks, and as time passed, she noticed that the women had become rather protective of her. Mirbella's lessons were having the desired effect, albeit slowly. Following the seesaw battle on Junction, the only way for the embattled sisterhood to survive the violence of the honored matres had been to let them believe they were victorious. In a philosophical turnabout, the captors actually became captives before they realized it. Bene Gesserit knowledge, training, and wiles subsumed their competitors' rigid beliefs. In most cases. At a hand signal, the Mother Commander caused her guards to tighten Anine's restraints. The woman's face contorted in pain. Mirbella descended the polished steps, never taking her eyes off the captive. Reaching the floor, Mirbella glared down at the shorter woman. It pleased her to see the eyes change, filling with fear instead of defiance as realization swept over her. Honored matres rarely bothered to hold back their emotions, choosing instead to exploit them. They found that a provocative, feral expression, a clear indication of anger and danger, could make their victims prone to submission. In sharp contrast, Reverend Mothers considered emotions a weakness and controlled them rigidly. "Over the years, I have met many challengers and killed them all," Mirbella said. I dueled with honored matres who did not acknowledge my rule. I stood up to Bene Gesserits who refused to accept what I am doing. How much more blood and time must I waste on this nonsense when we have a real enemy hunting us? Without releasing Anine's restraints or loosening her gag, Mirbella brought forth a gleaming dagger from her sash and thrust it into Anine's throat. No ceremony or dignity. No wasting of time. The guards held the dying prisoner up as she twitched and thrashed and gurgled half words, then slumped over, her eyes glassy and dead. Anine hadn't even made a mess on the floor. Remove her. Mirbella wiped the knife on the victim's plaid silk cape, then resumed her seat on the throne. I have more important business to take care of. Out in the galaxy, ruthless and untamed honored matres, still greatly outnumbering the Bene Gesserits, operated in independent cells, discreet groups. Many of those women refused to accept the Mother Commander's authority and continued their original plan of slash and burn, destroy and run. Before they could face the real enemy, Mirbella would have to bring them into line. All of them. Sensing that Odraed was once again available, Mirbella said to her dead mentor in the silence of her mind, I wish this sort of thing were not necessary. Your way is more brutal than I'd prefer, but your challenges are great and different from mine. I entrusted you with the task of the Sisterhood's survival. Now the work falls to you. You are dead and relegated to the role of observer. Odraed within chuckled. I find that role to be far less stressful. Throughout the internal exchange, Mirbella kept her face a placid mask since so many in the receiving hall were watching her. From beside the ornate throne, the aged and enormously fat Balanda leaned over. The guild ship has arrived. We are escorting their 6-member delegation here with all due speed. Belle had been Odraed's foil and companion. The two had disagreed a great deal, especially about the Duncan, Idaho project. I have decided to make them wait. No need to let them think we are anxious to see them. She knew what the guild wanted. Spice. Always the same. Spice. Belanda's chins folded together as she nodded. Certainly. We can find endless formalities to observe, if you wish. Give the guild a taste of their own bureaucracy. Legend holds that a pearl of Leto II's awareness remains within each of the sandworms that arose from his divided body. The God Emperor himself said he would henceforth live in an endless dream. But what if he should waken? When he sees what we have done with ourselves, will the tyrant laugh at us? Priestess Ardath, the cult of Shiana on the planet Dan. Though the desert planet had been roasted clean of all life, the soul of Dune survived aboard the no-ship. Shiana herself had seen to that. She and her sober-faced aide Garimi stood at the viewing window above the Ithaca's great hold. Garimi watched the shallow dunes stirring as the 7 captive sandworms moved. They have grown. The worms were smaller than the behemoths Shiana remembered from Rakkus, but larger than any she had seen on the overly moist desert band of Chapter House. The environmental controls in the ship's vast hold were precise enough to provide a perfect simulated desert. Shiana shook her head, knowing the creature's primitive memories must recall swimming through an endless sea of dunes. Our worms are crowded, restless. They have no place to go. Just before the horrors obliterated Rakkus, Shianna had rescued an ancient sandworm and transported it to Chapter House. Near death when it arrived, the mammoth creature broke down soon after it touched the fertile soil, and its skin fissioned into thousands of reproducing sand trout that burrowed into the ground. Over the next 14 years, those sand trout began to transform the lush world into another arid wasteland, a new home for the worms. Finally, when conditions were right, the magnificent creatures rose again. Small ones at first that over time would become larger and more powerful. When Shianna had decided to escape from Chapter House, she took some of the stunted sandworms with her. Fascinated by movement in the sand, Garimi leaned closer to the Plaz observation window. The dark-haired aide's expression was so serious it belonged on a woman decades older. Garimi was a workhorse, a true Bene Gesserit conservative who had the parochial tendency to see the world around her as straightforward, black and white. Though younger than Shianna, she clung more to Bene Gesserit purity and was deeply offended by the idea of the hated honored Matres joining the sisterhood. Garimi had helped Shianna develop the risky plan that allowed them to escape from the corruption. Looking at the restless worms, Garimi said, "Now that we are out of that other universe, when will Duncan find us a world? When will he decide we're safe?" The Ithaca had been built to serve as a great city in space. Artificially lit sectors were designed as greenhouses, while algae vats and recycling ponds provided less palatable food. Because it carried a relatively small number of passengers, the no-ship's supplies and scrubbing systems would provide edibles, air, and water for decades yet. The current population barely registered on the vessel's capacity. Shianna turned from the observation window. "I wasn't sure Duncan could ever return us to normal space, but now he's done so. Isn't that enough for now?"
"No. We must select a planet for our new Bene Gesserit headquarters, turn these worms loose, and convert it into another Rakkus. We must begin reproducing, building a new core for the sisterhood."
She rested her hands on narrow hips.
"We cannot keep wandering forever."
3 years is hardly forever. You are starting to sound like the rabbi. The younger woman looked uncertain, as if wondering whether to take the comment as a joke or a rebuke.
"The rabbi likes to complain. I think it comforts him. I was simply looking to our future."
"We will have a future, Garimi. Do not worry."
The aide's face brightened, turned hopeful.
"Are you speaking from prescience?"
"No, from my faith."
Day by day, Shianna consumed more of their hoarded spice than most. A dose sufficient for her to map out vague and fog-shrouded paths ahead of them. During the time that the Ithaca had been lost in the void, she had seen nothing. But since the recent unexpected lurch back into normal space, she had felt different. Better. The largest sandworm rose up in the cargo hold, its open maw like the mouth of a cave. The other worms stirred like a writhing nest of snakes. Two more heads emerged, and a powder of sand cascaded down. Garimi gasped in awe.
"Look, they can sense you, even up here."
"And I sense them."
Shianna placed her palms against the Plaz barrier, imagining that she could smell the melange on their breath even through the walls. Neither she nor the worms would be satisfied until they had a new desert on which to roam. But Duncan insisted they keep running to stay one step ahead of the hunters. Not everyone agreed with his plan, such as it was. Many aboard the ship had never wanted to come along on this journey in the first place. The rabbi and his refugee Jews, the Tleilaxu Sightail, and the four bestial futars. And what about the worms, she wondered. What do they truly want? All seven worms had surfaced now, their eyeless heads questing back and forth. A troubled look crossed Garimi's hardened face. Do you think the tyrant is really in there? A pearl of awareness in an endless dream? Can he sense that you are special? Because I am his 100 times removed great-grandniece? Perhaps. Certainly no one on Rakkus expected a little girl from an isolated desert village to be able to command the great worms. The corrupt priesthood on Rakkus had seen Shiana as a link to their divided god. Later, the Bene Gesserit's Missionaria Protectiva created legends about Shiana, shaping her into an earth mother, a holy virgin. As far as the population of the old empire knew, their revered Shiana had perished along with Rakkus. A religion had grown up around her supposed martyrdom, becoming yet another weapon for the sisterhood to use. They were undoubtedly still exploiting her name and legend. All of us believe in you, Shiana. That is why we came on this. Garimi caught herself, as if on the verge of uttering a deprecatory word. On this odyssey.